This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black voters turned out in huge numbers and won the Democrats a seat in the U.S. Senate from Alabama. But what are the Democrats prepared to do for Black people? And Mumia Abu-Jamal gives his sign of approval to a new book on the many ways that police get away with murder in America. But first, the Internet may never be the same again after the FCC's gutting of Internet neutrality protections. Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai, a former lawyer for Verizon, handed corporations unprecedented control over how the Internet will operate. Tim Carr of the media advocacy group Free Press is confident that Internet neutrality can be rescued.
There are a number of ways that you can reverse a decision like this. One is in Congress. Congress has something called the Congressional Review Act that allows them to pass a resolution of disapproval regarding any rules or regulations that have been recently passed. If Congress makes that vote, then that would void this decision. The other path is the one that we're taking, is to sue the agency in a federal appeals court and to establish, in the case that we'll be making, to establish that it doesn't follow the law, that there were a number of procedural missteps over the course of the rulemaking, and that there are a number of points where their justification for passing this order is simply wrong on the facts.
From your past experience with the courts, what kind of timeline are we talking about just to get a decision from that venue?
Well, it's hard to say, because when rules like this are passed within federal agencies, it has to hit something called the Federal Register. The Federal Register is the official record of regulations and rules of government, and sometimes it takes a number of weeks in order for that language to hit the register. Once it's in the register, that is usually the time at which you can appeal a decision, and we have to appeal these sorts of decisions to a federal appellate court. So there is a somewhat, you know, wonky legal process that is now, you know, the timeline or the clock for has now started. And, you know, we're preparing our complaint and we'll be ready when the time comes to file.
You guys seem to think that the public is behind you and you can use that time to good effect.
Yeah, well, we don't just think that the public is behind us. There have been several polls, including one that was recently published and covered in the Washington Post, that shows that this is one policy issue on which there's wide bipartisan support. 83% of the American public supports net neutrality and opposes the ruling that just passed at the FCC. And that's reflected also in the overwhelming support for net neutrality protections that were filed by public comments in the FCC docket over the course of this proceeding. Internet users should have control over what they do and where they go online. And I think people are very accustomed to that. They're accustomed to, whenever they go online, being able to choose their own media experience, to choose what websites and services that they want to use without the fear of their internet access provider in some way blocking or throttling their ability to do so. So I think that a lot of people are passionate about this because they do understand what's at stake. And what really is at stake here is who controls the future of communications. Chairman Pai at the FCC handed that control over to a small handful of very large phone and cable companies that control internet access for the majority of Americans. The FCC chairman has completely disregarded public opinion on this matter, and he's completely dismissive of the passion of the American public around this issue. We are indeed frustrated that this chairman has not been listening at all to overwhelming consensus, both on the left and on the right, that net neutrality rules are important. I think what happened today was one of the more corrupt decisions that we've seen from this government in recent history. And one of the main problems is that this leadership, the new leadership at the FCC, chose to completely disregard public opinion when taking this matter into their hands.
Corrupt is a very loaded word, politically and morally and legally.
Yes, it is. This is a very corrupt process. It involves individuals who are captured by industry, who have spread misinformation about the issue and made a decision, very undemocratic decision, that ignored the will of the public. I think corruption is a fair assessment of what just happened at the FCC.
That was Tim Carr of the media advocacy group Free Press. Victor Picard is an associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the book America's Battle for Media Democracy. Professor Picard recently wrote an article on the corporate role in creating what he called the misinformation society. Picard agrees that the FCC has been captured by the very corporations it was supposed to regulate.
This is something out of mainstream economic textbooks that basically characterizes a situation where you have a regulatory agency that has internalized the value system and the logics of the industries it is purportedly meant to regulate. So to be more specific, in this case, we have very consistent behavior, not just with this recent net neutrality decision, but just looking at what the FCC has done over the last 10 months, they basically have satisfied a longstanding wish list for the telecommunication and broadcast industries. So basically everything that those industries have wanted, have been asking for many years in most cases, this FCC, specifically this FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, has rapidly sought to grant these wishes. And it's remarkable. I don't think there's anything in our history that comes close to this.
Well, certainly Chairman Pai, as a former lawyer for Verizon, would know what's on that wish list. So what do you think is on it? What's next?
You're absolutely right. This has been a longstanding agenda of his as well. And, you know, it's hard to predict exactly what wish he'll grant next, but it's pretty clear he's going to continue to offer greater media concentration. He certainly has been making a lot of decisions that just coincidentally are exactly decisions that help the Sinclair Broadcast Group, which is set to become a massive media network. It's going to have basically over 70% of American homes will have access to this very conservative local television broadcast owner. So I think we have many reasons to be concerned about this trajectory that we're on.
You speak of corporate concentration. It's almost difficult to imagine how more concentrated it can become. The titans of media, you could roll off their names in less than 10 seconds.
This is true. And of course, we just found out that Fox and Disney are entering an enormous merger. So yes, you're absolutely right. It's important to remember that it was already a highly concentrated media system. And now we're seeing the few protections, the few barriers that were still on the books being tossed out. So we really are getting to the point where it's just a handful of corporations that command almost our entire media system, whether we're talking about internet service providers or content creators. It's really just a handful of corporate titans behind this content.
And whether it's five of them or 20, they're all corporate titans and think similarly. What kind of world are they trying to create and project?
Yes, and I think that's another key point. It's important for us to look at the ownership structures behind the media that we're immersed in. But I think what's even more telling is this commercial logic that's driving it. There are profit imperatives that dictate the content decisions that these media organizations are constantly making. So it's not simply that media are giving people what they want. Media are giving people what they think will make a lot of money, or in other words, what advertisers will pay a lot of money for. And that commercial logic is really what explains the kind of media that we're immersed in, a media system that really doesn't offer a wide range of diverse opinions or voices. And it's easy to say this just reflects the audience's desire, but it's actually more, I think, connected to this commercial imperative that's driving their media content.
And this leads to the creation of what you've described as a misinformation society.
That's right. This misinformation problem is attracting well-deserved attention, but too rarely do people look at the structural roots. Very rarely do people look at the policy decisions that led this particular kind of media system that consistently gives us this standard fare, a system that sensationalizes important political issues, a system that's constantly trying to simply entertain us and not inform us, treats us as consumers, not citizens. This is not a natural system. It was not inevitable, but there are particular policies that created this system.
Yes, many of us have argued that the fake news syndrome is not symptomatic of intrusion into the media by activists and citizens and their version of reality, experienced reality, but the fault of the corporate owners who spread fake news all of the time.
That's right. I mean, these corporate owners, whether we're talking about Facebook or Fox, they're profiting from this kind of misinformation. It tends to be very sensational, controversial. It attracts eyeballs, which in turn is selling advertising to these captive audiences. So it's highly profitable. And we have allowed these corporations to become so powerful and so irresponsible. And again, it goes back to policies. It's not simply natural. It's a political choice. And I think as a informed populace, we have to fight for better policies and to try to create a better media system.
And when we hear people like Chairman Pai, it seems that he thinks it is a received wisdom that the internet should be a vehicle for private enterprise and the views of those who can afford to put them out in media.
That's right. He clearly treats the internet as a commodity, as a luxury, not a necessity, not a utility. And if you listen to his comments at the FCC, as he was making his net neutrality decision, he basically was saying that it's because of the free market that we have the internet. It's because of the magic of technology and free market forces that has led to this innovation that gave us the internet. But that's deeply ahistorical. It's a complete myth. We got the internet because of tremendous public subsidies and public interest regulations. It's things like net neutrality. It's things like common carrier protections that gave us the internet that we have today, that made it a democratic space. And that's exactly what Chairman Pai is sacrificing.
And since the United States still dominates the global internet, what does this FCC decision, what kind of impact does it have on the rest of the world of the internet?
That's a great question. Whenever we talk about the internet, we have to remember that it's inherently a global resource. And in this case, it's unfortunate that the U.S. has such a disproportionate influence on how the internet is governed. And I'm already hearing from Canadians, from people from other countries who are telling me that this decision is bad news for them as well. We often set the course for the way other countries begin to set their regulations. And unfortunately, this could have some really detrimental effects. On the other hand, though, we can point to countries like Canada and India, which just recently have strengthened their net neutrality protection. So hopefully other countries will be more sensible and stick to their guns, as it were, with their net neutrality protections.
And politically, how does this connect with the controversy over fake news and who has a right to have a presence on the internet?
Well, I think this connects to the so-called fake news. I prefer to call it misinformation. But it basically connects to these broader questions about monopoly power in our media, in our news and information systems. And whether we're talking about internet service providers, which increasingly will be able to serve as gatekeepers, whether we're talking about platform monopoly like Facebook and Google, you know, these countries have tremendous power over the kind of information we're able to access. And right now, they have exhibited very little social responsibility. So I'm actually weirdly, perhaps cautiously optimistic that we're beginning to see a growing awareness about these problems, and we're beginning to see an anti-monopoly movement rise up that I think will start challenging these companies on a structural level. So we'll start seeing hopefully some more antitrust measures and things that can try to rein them in.
Political activists found a home on the internet not just because of the wonderful characteristics of the medium, but also because it was prohibitive to put out publications in the old printed way, prohibitive economically. What are we looking at if the titans of industry further clamp down on access in terms of the political impact, organizing?
Yes, too often this debate gets treated as a kind of technocratic squabble. You know, it might interfere with our entertainment, our online access to entertainment media, but this is deeply a political problem. This is giving internet service providers the power to censor content, and that's going to disproportionately hurt journalists and activists for two reasons. One, because of their views often will go against monopoly power, will go against corporate interests. But secondly, with this new internet without net neutrality protections, there's likely going to be a payola system where you have to basically pay to play. You have to pay to be in those fast lanes. And activists simply will not have the resources that huge corporations will have. And they're going to be disproportionately hurt by this new kind of internet.
And we know what that did to radio with their very abbreviated playlists and everybody listening to the same song. That would be disastrous in a political sense.
Absolutely. I mean, we can imagine that soon you'll have premium content. You'll have 10 sites that you can visit with a particular package that you have to pay a tremendous amount of money for. And it's really going to hurt these smaller outlets. It's going to hurt views that fall outside the mainstream. So you end up with this very formulaic internet. And no one wants this. It sounds very dystopian, but this is exactly what could happen without net neutrality protection.
Yes, I remember, of course, and so do you, when cable was all the rage and the corporations were talking about, well, this proliferation of channels would bring a proliferation of views and cultures and human experience to be shared. But that hasn't happened because the same corporations own the cable.
That's right. And we can look throughout history, whether we're talking about cable or broadcast media before that. There was always this initial democratic promise, this potential that this new technology could be used to liberate society, to revolutionize the way that we govern ourselves and talk amongst ourselves. But what happens with this corporate capture that policies allow to happen, that we squander this democratic potential. So this is history replaying itself, unfortunately, but I don't think it's inevitable. I think we could still turn this back.
And I assume turning it back involves all these constituent groups that will see themselves shut out of the world of communications, actually treating this as a kind of human rights issue.
That's right. I think it has to be framed as a human rights issue, as a democratic issue. This is really about a social contract between the public, between these internet corporations, and between government. And that's something that we have to constantly remind ourselves. This is not some technical, wonky debate. This is really about democracy.
Back in 2003, we saw these kinds of corporate aggressions against the electronic universe. And they were not reversed, but effectively resisted. Do you think we can have a repeat of that kind of mobilization?
I do think so. I mean, if you look at the activism that's been happening around this net neutrality debate, people are engaged. Millions of people are writing the FCC. Hundreds of thousands of people are calling their congressional representatives. I think that people are paying attention to this. And, you know, once it's explained to them how this is going to affect their daily lives, I think they're going to intervene. So yes, I would cast my vote with the social movements and the activists that are beginning to emerge around this issue. For the long term, I am optimistic, but for the short term, there's a hell of a fight in front of us.
Yes, if you read the corporate media, they see the alignment of forces as being corporations like Verizon as opposed to other corporations like Google.
That's right. This has often been misframed as battle between corporate titans, between the content providers like Google, perhaps Netflix, and then the big internet service providers. There might have been earlier iterations of this debate where that was more prominent, but this is something that affects people, and especially in the recent years around this fight, it's been mostly these public interest groups that have been leading the charge against repealing net neutrality. And back in 2014, 2015, it was those groups that pushed the strong net neutrality protections that we ended up with. So I think it's wrong to characterize this as simply a fight between big companies. For the long term, we also have to look at structural alternatives where there is an actual public option for internet access. And here I'm talking specifically about municipal and community owned and controlled broadband networks. I think for the long term, that's the struggle that we really have to get behind, because that provides an actual way to circumvent these internet service monopolies that really have a stranglehold on internet access right now. So I think we need to be looking at public ownership of key communication infrastructures for the future.
So we're not just talking about rules and regulations, but the creation of actual infrastructure that serves the public.
That's right. I mean, I think that's the best systemic fix to this problem. In the meantime, we can't give up on fights like net neutrality. But if we actually had true competition, if we weren't at the mercy of these internet service monopolies, then this would not even be a major problem, because if someone started messing with our online content, we could just dump that service provider and go with a competitor. But most Americans have access to only one, maybe two major internet service providers in their communities. So I think we need to start looking at building out public alternatives, community-owned and operated broadband networks.
Something like an internet counterpart to what public television and radio at least were supposed to be at their inception.
That's right. I think that's a very good, very apt parallel to think about, not just in terms of do we regulate these corporate monopolies or do we let them do whatever they want. The idea would be to build true structural alternatives that are publicly owned and operated and actually serve the public interest. I think that should always be the long-term goal.
Professor Victor Picard of the Annenberg School of Communications. Black voters are universally credited with defeating Roy Moore's bid to become the next U.S. Senator from Alabama. The far-right Republican is accused of having inappropriate relations with teenage girls decades ago. He believes homosexuality is evil and has said that the United States was a really great country back during slavery. Roy Moore lost the special election by only 1.5 percentage points. Black women voted for his Democratic opponent at levels of 98%, and black men were not far behind. The New York Times and other corporate media acknowledge that black voters saved the day for the Democrats, but there has been very little media coverage that puts the black political struggle in the South in any real historical context. We spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, a veteran black activist and author in Columbia, South Carolina.
Well, you won't see anything about the black struggle and progressive politics and the history of it and how we got to where we are in the pages of the New York Times or on TV, because it seems like a lot of folk have an idea of black politics, meaning Martin Luther King and Barack Obama, and that's all they know. They don't realize that there is a history of organizing in the South that goes back to the Organizing for the Right to Vote Act, which is centered in Alabama and Selma and across the Black Belt. And so you've long had organizations like the Alabama New South Coalition that formed in the 80s to try to advance a progressive agenda. And what has happened more often than not, the Democratic Party, the state Democratic parties, have rejected it. And for the most part, if you look at it from the top, the Clintons and the Clinton crack that the Democrats seem to be under, still, it was the black agenda, which has been a progressive agenda, fighting against the DLC agenda, which has been corporatism and Republican light. And that's one of the major reasons that you haven't had a mobilization of black voters in the South in a long time. But I think things are changing, as evidenced in Alabama, partly because of Trump, partly because You have just bare-bone racist crackers such as Roy Moore running for office, and you have the whole image of the White House and white men in power dominating the airwaves, that it serves to mobilize black voters because they truly understand in their bones this whole ripping off of the mask of white supremacy and corporatism in America, and I think there's going to be some pushback on that.
Well, you use the term progressive, but we don't see much talk about the content of these political campaigns. There's a focus on black turnout, and that's it.
And it's always been, as I said, up until the Alabama election, it's usually Democrats go after black voters 2 or 3 weeks before the election, and they show up in your churches and at your events, and that's it. There is no infrastructure. But there's no infrastructure for progressive politics in this country. There's just an infrastructure for voting, and that's a problem. I mean, if we want to make change, we're going to have to build democratic progressive organizations across the South that understand multi-issue coalition building. That's always been what we've had to do, and not really waiting for the Democratic Party to do anything special for us, because that's not how it's going to work. As it relates to how the game is played, and knowing that the most important thing coming up in the next couple of years is going to be reapportionment, and if we really want to take over politics in this country, it has to be at the local level and at the state level, where you challenge people to go out and vote at city and county elections, and you change the nature of these state legislatures, because that's where the redistricting fight is going to go on.
There was great hope for black political mobilization, black power, black electoral activity back in the 80s, when in 1984 and 1988, Reverend Jesse Jackson ran for president twice, and his campaigns were largely huge black voter registration drives centered in the South.
And a lot of the infrastructure of the Democratic Party, as far as the functionaries of the party, the ones that volunteer, that work at polls, a lot of that is still the old Jackson coalition. And as far as organizing in the South and going to the plant gates, you can criticize a lot about Jesse Jackson. But back during that, I would say from when we were fighting to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act in 78 through the 84 elections and the 88 elections, Jackson was at the plant gates, helped working people mobilize. Jackson was across the South doing these voter registration drives, and he was successful. So if you can organize, you can achieve some victories. A lot of what came off of Jackson's organizing, or the organizing in the South, as I said earlier, the formation of the Alabama New South Coalition, which was active in the election on Tuesday, the Southern Rainbow Education Project, which was Ann Braden and Gwen Patton and Scott Douglas and people across the South, the Southern Organizers Committee, you had a lot of stuff going on back during the 80s, along the lines of progressive politics, the anti-nuclear movement, the anti-nuclear bombs movement, the environmental justice movement, and the coining of the phrase environmental racism. You had all these things going on between the 80s and the Jackson campaign as far as progressive politics and having a good base of political activism in the South. And that's what we have to recreate. You can't ignore the South. You can't ignore the issues. But we do have to be involved, I think, more importantly, in changing the nature of the state houses. And it can't be just about the Democratic Party. It's got to be expanding the system to include third parties. I'm hoping out of Alabama that we can run a Green Party candidate for the Senate, as we ran when DeMint retired and challenged Tim Scott and challenge Lindsey Graham. We have to do some organizing.
Well, what happened after that very hopeful and energetic period in the 80s and the early 90s?
No, Jackson became a Democrat, and that killed, that hurt us to a large extent, and the Rainbow became more of a functionary of the Democratic Party, and there were people that built the local coalitions that knew that that would be the death of organizing in the South, and it has hurt us. The failure of the Rainbow Coalition, for everything it did in the past, the failure of the Rainbow Coalition was to become so ingrained in Democratic Party politics and to not develop a Democratic state national model and Democratic models on the local level that's what happened to the rainbow. Now, that's not to say a rainbow-like organization can't emerge. And as I said, the rainbow was a true multiracial, multi-issue coalition. That is a good model to follow.
This rainbow, if it is to resurge, would run into a lot of black Democratic opposition. We see in Alabama, the sole black person in Congress is Terry Sewell. She was rated by Black Agenda Report as the worst or one of the two worst members of the Congressional Black Caucus, no progressive by any measure. And in Mississippi, the only black congressman is Benny Thompson, who's all caught up in national security issues, and both of them vote for these huge war budgets.
We have to build a movement and an organization or organizations that advance what a progressive agenda is. Clearly, a consistent, coherent, progressive agenda. And we have to call people to account for not supporting our interests otherwise. I commend Black Agenda Report for doing that, or for calling people out where they are. As I said, I have a relationship with Reverend Jackson today, but as far as the politics of what led to the demise of the rainbow, I'm very clear about that. We weren't democratic, and we didn't set up structures around the country that had a democratic model, and that led to its failure. But as far as institutionally what it left in place, the idea of proportional representation, which the Obama folk came in and they wanted after they started winning, they wanted to do away with proportional representation. They wanted to do winner take all. But proportional representation just isn't about an election. It's about participation in civic and political life at large. And it also advances the idea of a multi-party system and cumulative voting. That is what's progressive. That is where we ought to be going. And those are the kinds of issues that us folk who claim to be progressive ought to be advocating and educating people on in the community.
Well, let's talk about proportional representation, which is of huge importance in the Deep South, where whites vote as a white bloc in places like Alabama and Mississippi. You have 80 and 90% of the white folks voting for the Republican Party, which is the white man's party. And in a place like Alabama, with about a quarter of the population black and 30% of the electorate, if they get really riled up, like this past Tuesday, that white bloc is almost insurmountable, and proportional representation is the only formula that can even approach giving black folks some kind of representation.
Well, you know, we're looking at all these athletes kneeling and wanting to take a political stand. We need to be doing some political education with a lot of these folk who are out there on the front lines as to what is progressive, where you ought to be spending money and resources in trying to advance. It's easy for athletes to donate money to some sort of children's cause or to cure cancer, and all those things are important. But as far as the politics are concerned and changing the nature of the laws, we need progressive organizations funded, and there's no way around that. I mean, hopefully in the future, as we define what progressive politics are, we'll have to put pressure on those that have the resources to support the politics and not think that it's going to come on the cheap and that freedom is free. It's not free.
Where are the signs of life and of promise in black political activity in the Deep South, not just in Alabama, but in your part of the woods in South Carolina?
As I said, because folk are being pushed out of the cities, education is becoming more expensive. And we have black elected officials that are in office, but they seem to be serving the corporate master. I think that people are primed to be mobilized for change. No question, Trump is a mobilizer, and white supremacy in the face of white supremacy is a mobilizer. But beyond that are the policies that underline that. And that's where we have to turn up the heat. So I think that things are looking up now, but you can sense in how people are talking about politics and how people have really seen that you can wait for white people to sort out who they are, because a lot of this election and a lot of the presidential election and who's in power now and how things have gone over the last year, and black folk being reasonably quiet, except for going out to the polls and quietly voting against this whole idea of white supremacy government, the image of it, even though underlying it all is the real power of it.
And that's why you're talking about creating a progressive agenda, making demands so that folks aren't expected to just mobilize to go out and vote against a Roy Moore or some other just like him somewhere, but for something, for a black agenda.
Right. I mean, it's not about voting against something that's negative. It's always going to be about voting for something that's positive. And so, as I said, I think because the economy, although folk want to tell you is great, is not so great. The people that are working in the retail fields now, they're worried about their jobs being taken by the big companies offline. There's a whole idea of endless war and perhaps even the threat of nuclear war and forcing these kids to go fight in places where they're not going to come home. All these secret wars going on in Africa. And if you're in the South, you've got somebody that's in the military. All these things, people are talking about them and talking about the people that have the control to send you to your peril or to make things easy or hard. And the idea of insurance. I just had surgery, and you know, just the cost of any kind of medical treatment can put you in bankruptcy. And this whole attack on basically the FDR New Deal and Great Society's social safety net, everything is being laid bare. Donald Trump lays bare what the system is really about. He has exposed both Democrats and Republicans, himself included, as to what the system is really about. And for the first 100 days, black folk have kind of said, okay, let white folks sort out who they are. Let's not get involved in this. This is them deciding what the future is going to be and how they're going to be perceived, not just to black people, but to the world. But you can't just sit back and let white folk decide who they're going to be, because ultimately it's going to affect you. And I think black folk are coming to that idea that they've got to mobilize because they will be affected.
Yes, an anti-Trump movement is not necessarily a progressive movement and not necessarily a black-friendly movement.
Well, I think that white supremacy and the raw face of white supremacy is a mobilizer. It's so clear. I mean, when you have Obama in office or a neoliberal Democrat and polite racism, you know, it's hard to mobilize against that. But when you have it so clear with just white men in power doing anything they want to do, passing everything that they've wanted to pass for years and years and years, I think that motivates people. And so it's not necessarily anti-Trump. I think it's anti-white supremacy.
If it is anti-white supremacy, and of course it is in the black community, it must put forward a program that actually does do battle with white supremacy, and not just the presence of repulsive whites.
Well, you're not going to get any disagreement from me on that one, but it's up to us to help craft that agenda and critique folk who participate in our politics per what we believe progressivism is and where it takes us. You can't expect the master to teach you or to organize for you. I mean, that's what we have to do in the community. That's the role of Glenn Ford as a community activist and Kevin Gray as a community activist, Rose Sanders, Hank Sanders. That's our responsibility. The folk who run for office under the blessing of a corporate party, their interest is always going to take into account first who writes their paycheck. And the idea of challenging, really challenging what white supremacy means and talking about it in a language where you're not mealy-mouthed, that's for us to do, because those folk that are in Washington, many of the ones that we sent to the state legislatures, they're not going to do it. They're not going to upset their masters.
Yes, and that's quite clear. For example, as soon as the returns were in 2016, John Lewis, who has made his reputation talking about voting rights, the first thing out of his mouth, instead of talking about black voter suppression and what role that played in the election, he just wanted to badmouth the Russians.
Well, on the Russian stuff, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I believe that the United States interferes in elections. I believe that Russia interferes in elections. I believe that Putin and Netanyahu represent white supremacy too, and that Russia and the Russians are not necessarily friends of black people. And even though I disagree with everything that Barack Obama stood for as a corporate Democrat, I believe that Putin and Netanyahu in particular, and throwing Donald Trump, how they treat and deal with Obama or dealt with Obama was a metaphor for what they thought about black folk, period. That I don't care how much you capitulate to the corporatism and empire, you're still a nigger. And they don't believe that black people have any right to rule. Now, that's what I believe about white supremacy, be it Zionist white supremacy or be it a white supremacy that was bred in the Caucasus or bred in New York. Now, going to war with Russia, I don't think that that's going to happen. But as far as the politics of global white supremacy is concerned, I don't see a difference between these guys at all. Look, I don't think the FBI is our friend. I might agree with Donald Trump on that. I don't believe the CIA is our friend. I do believe there's such a thing as a deep state, and I'm a person that believes in transparency. So, I mean, there are some things that I might agree with Trump on. Do I think that he's a crook? Sure, I believe he's a crook. But I also think that as it relates to all this Russian stuff, it is a hysteria. And so I kind of tune it out because I'm hoping that this too shall pass, this hysteria shall pass. And the idea that we want to cast Russia solely as an enemy only benefits the arms dealers and the Pentagon and the deep state. Now, that I believe. I don't think that black folk should invest a whole lot of energy in following up on the hysteria and this whole idea of if it weren't for the Russians, Hillary Clinton would be president. Hillary Clinton would have been a hawk, too. Hillary Clinton had a whole lot of other problems besides Russia. And I don't believe it's because of Russia that Hillary Clinton lost an election. I believe that she was just a corporate candidate and her husband used government to get rich, like a lot of politicians do. I don't buy off into the hysteria. I just kind of, it's there. Really, I cheer for people getting prosecuted. Why wouldn't I want to see every one of those folk that work with Donald Trump or work with the Clinton administration called to task for being so corrupt for so long? That's the problem with our politics in this country. There are no citizens politicians. Everybody goes in for their own personal power, and people have forgotten this idea of service. I was in the military. You know, I'm one of those folk that believe you serve when it's just, hopefully, and you go home. You're not in government to make a career out of it. I don't believe in this idea of professional politicians. I believe in citizens politicians.
And finally, do you think that the South, and especially the black electorate in the South, is fertile ground for third-party efforts?
Well, everything takes money. I mean, if the third parties are not going to raise the resources to really organize itself, to penetrate communities, to have a plan to educate people as to why they ought to go with them. I've been a third-party person. I've run as a third-party candidate and have fought to keep third parties on the ballots and not have the other two parties determine when they have the conventions and who it is that they run. But it still means that those parties have to be serious in reaching out. It can't be just running for president or running every 4 years. But I think that in the future, if you believe in a multi-party system, some effort and some resources is going to have to be put together to make it happen. I would love for there to be a strong Green Party in the United States. I would love for there to be a new party. I worked back with Danny Kanter and Steve Coblin and Wade Rasky and some folk in forming the new party before it became the Working People's Party. So I think that you have to, as they say, kick that can down the road. But at some point in time, folk got to put their money where their mouths are. Instead of just kneeling, come out your pocket and support the politics. And folk like us got to kind of lay out what those politics are.
That was author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray speaking from Columbia, South Carolina. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has turned out another book titled Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? Abu Jamal has been behind bars for 35 years in the death of a Philadelphia policeman, but his supporters around the nation and the world have been holding book parties to celebrate the new publication and to demand Mumia's release from prison. Robin Spencer attended one of those Mumia book parties at Raw Space in New York's Harlem. Spencer is an historian with the campaign to bring Mumia home.
The campaign to bring Mumia home worked very hard to shape public awareness about Mumia Abu-Jamal's latest book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? The book is a collection of his writings on issues around police brutality and violence. And really, he wrote it for the Black Lives Matter movement. He's very inspired by the young people and their vision of activism, and he wrote it to really bring together all of those stories of loss and violence and resistance that have been going on in this country over the past few decades. So it's a really great book in that it contains short excerpts from Mumia's writings, and it gives you a wide sort of chronological view of a growing movement against police brutality and violence. So the campaign wanted to celebrate this amazing achievement that Mumia Abu-Jamal did, even though he's incarcerated, even though he's still suffering from medical neglect and dealing with a skin condition and all of that. So we put together a book party. And the great thing about the book party that made it unique is that two of our members were able to visit Mumia Abu-Jamal, where he is in SCI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania. I was one of them. And we got a chance to speak to Mumia himself and to hear from him what were his favorite things, his favorite colors, his favorite things to drink, the things that he liked to snack on, the type of cake he liked. And we put all of that into the book party. So it was a very intimate event, even though eventually there were about 150 people cycling in and out of Raw Space Gallery where it was held. But it had that feeling of really being curated by Mumia. It gave people a different perception and persona about who he was, what might it be like if he was there. We created a life-size photo of Mumia. We photoshopped the prison garb off of him and put him into the type of clothing that he would want to wear if he was outside here with us. So people were able to come and experience Mumia in a different way. They were able to get a stamped copy of his book with his signature, which he did particularly for this event. They were able to hear from him. He called in. We had scholar extraordinaire Gerald Horn call in and talk about radical politics in the prison industrial complex and the role of political prisoners in the whole machinery. It was a very powerful event. Of course, we had Pam Africa and lots of supporters from Philadelphia and other parts of the country as well.
Mumia has been in prison for 35 years. He was a member of the Panther Party, active in a movement of a previous generation. And so his critique, his analysis of the current movement with Black Lives Matter in the focus is an important one historically.
Definitely. I think that Mumia has a very unique and strong political vision. The analysis that he makes, I think, are necessary and needed for activists to grapple with, because he gets to the fundamental structural realities that we are facing and the potential of what kind of activism to overturn those conditions and move us more towards greater freedom.
And of course, you're a member of the campaign to bring Mumia home, and the latest events on the legal front will have an impact, you hope, on bringing that time near.
Yes, yes. We're mobilizing now for an evidentiary hearing that's being held for Mumia on Wednesday, January 17th in Philadelphia. It really will give us an opportunity to pack the courts to really raise awareness over how important it is to keep Mumia's case in the public eye and to at every turn be centrally involved in his case as it winds its way through the system.
And for all these 35 years, the pressure has mostly come from the streets.
There was a very successful march and teach-in in Philadelphia on December 9th that was incredibly successful in bringing out and continuing to raise awareness about Mumia's case, especially because of the attention given to Meek Mills and his situation in the criminal justice system. There's a kind of an opening, I think, to even bring a broader swath of people into the movement and to have them think about the connections between the criminal justice system and political prisoners and their history in the system. Now, the campaign to bring Mumia home has a full slate of events for 2018 already. In all of these debates and dialogue about white supremacy, we'll be bringing Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the scholar activist who has written an incredible book called Loaded, The History of the Second Amendment in America, talking about the right to bear arms and its white supremacist history. Her book is really, I think, creating a lot of interesting dialogue, and is also countering some of the ideals about the roots of white supremacy that are out there. We're bringing her in conversation with Pam Africa, and that's going to take place in New York in early January. Of course, we always mobilize for Mumia's birthday in April. We'll be having a study group for people to read his book and get together with others to talk about his book. We have many events that we have coming up in 2018.
Mumia's health has not been the best because of the medical conditions that were exacerbated certainly by his imprisonment. How are his spirits, and how are the spirits of those who support him as we go into this new year?
Well, our spirits are high. I think Mumia continues to really be a beacon. He continues to be positive and upbeat. When he called into the book party, he delighted us with his humor. He talked about the recent firing of Omarosa from the White House. And it was amazing to sort of get a sense that he is also keeping up with the news. He is also reading what's happening out here in the world, reacting to it, responding to it, analyzing it, finding humor, ironic humor, in the convulsions of this new wave of white supremacy as it tries to unfold its tentacles on the rest of us. But it was really amazing to see that he is in good spirits. He keeps his smile ready. And I think the people who support him and love him, he keeps us motivated. He keeps us moving, because it's very clear that the injustice that he has endured over 10,000 days in solitary confinement, the continuing imprisonment that he faces there in SCI Mahanoy, and the way in which his case is just one of many political prisoners, I think it keeps us all motivated. It's beautiful to see that some political prisoners have been able to gain release, like Sekou Odinga and others. There have been more and more political prisoners who have been released, so we know that the pressure valve, the pressure can work, and it's important to understand that Mumia will be freed, and then there will be other political prisoners to work on their cases. And the larger goal is, of course, to raise the narrative of prison abolition.
That was Robin Spencer of the campaign to bring Mumia home, speaking from New York City. From his place of confinement in the Pennsylvania prison system, Mumia gave high praise to another activist's book.
Her name is distinctly and deliciously Black. A young scholar named Junga Yamata Taylor has recently authored a book that promises to open eyes as well as minds. It's titled, From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, put out last year from Haymarket Book in Chicago. In it, Taylor examines the violent impunity of the cops and their racist disdain for black life, the very thing that sparked black rebellions across the 20th century, from Watts in California to Overtown in Florida. She charted the explosive growth of the Black Lives Matter movement and related organizations nationally. She also gives a failing grade to black politicians, for many of them had no idea how to respond to one of the most pressing problems facing black people, police terror. Her critique of black politicians show that they differ little from their white predecessors except for their color. For Professor Taylor, few so-called black political leaders, many of whom signed on to mass incarceration train engineered by Bill Clinton, get a pass. Her work is thoughtful, honest, critical, and insightful. She does great credit to the scholar's art. Several years ago, law professor Michelle Alexander rocked the house with her remarkable book, The New Jim Crow. Now, it's Kiangi Yamata Taylor's turn. From hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.